Hi, I'm Leonard Lope. The following segment was produced by my staff, and I'll be hearing it for the first time along with you, so let's hope that we all enjoy it. Since this is the last day of this year's Winter Fun Drive, you can still give us a call at 888-376-9692 to become a member, or you can make an e-pledge at WNYC.org.
25 years ago today, WNYC AM sounded a little like this.
This is New York Public Radio, WNYC, and you're listening to Senior Edition, heard weekdays from noon to 4 o'clock.
On March 5th, 1985, Leonard Lopate became the host of Senior Edition, the afternoon talk show on WNYC that would come to be called New York & Company.
Good afternoon, I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome to New York & Company.
And then more to the point, The Leonard Lopate Show.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Brooke Gladstone. Today we're celebrating Leonard Lopate's quarter century on WNYC. It's an achievement on many levels, but let's start with the arithmetic of live radio. One daily show broadcast five times a week for 25 years equals 6,500 complete programs. Multiply that by the number of hours Leonard's been on the air, okay, that's changed a little over the years, and you arrive at nearly 15,000 hours of live radio. Then multiply that by the number of guests per hour, usually two, and you are left with the conservative sum of 30,000 conversations. And consider, these are Leonard Lopate conversations, not fleeting exchanges, but probing, sometimes funny, often unpredictable encounters with original minds and passionate hearts. Leonard's staff has sifted through the tapes, and so today you'll hear their best effort to craft a retrospective of those conversations in a single hour. It wasn't easy. So what explains the longevity of the show and the loyalty of you listeners? Well, on any given day, you might hear a Nobel Prize-winning physicist or a Tuvan throat singer. Over the years, you've heard President Carter, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Yitzhak Rabin, Tony Bennett, Toni Morrison, Yogi Berra, Willie Nelson, Edward Albee. Marcel Marceau actually spoke. Leonard even interviewed the inventor of the female condom, but we'll have more on that later. Of course, Lenny's passions shape the show's content. Food, for instance. He's always trying to interact with food in new ways. I mean, just eating it is such a cliche. Also hard on listeners. So, in this James Beard award-winning segment from 2005, Lenny, together with former gourmet editor-in-chief Ruth Reichel, Chef Daniel Belloud, and Dr. Marcia Pelsha, brought the power of smell to the radio.
What we have here are three distinctively flavored jelly bellies. We have licorice, coffee or root beer, and banana. And I will demonstrate, this is a delicate scientific experiment. I'm going to put the nose clips on.
How fun is to talk when you have the...
Right.
We're all
going
to
so we're all wearing...
We're all punching our nose.
Right, our souvenir nose clips. Now, everybody, make sure your nose is really closed.
If you're just tuning in, this is an experiment.
Okay.
This is not...
You don't want to cheat.
This is not what your public radio normally sounds like.
Right.
It's very efficient.
Right. Much more mellow voices. Okay. So close your eyes. Mix up the jelly bellies. Oh. Don't look at which one you've taken.
One thing I can tell you already, I don't like banana.
So. Well, that's okay. You're doing it for science. So begin to chew with the nose clips on. Before you swallow, take the nose clips off and see whether it becomes any more obvious.
Oh, yeah.
Which flavor you have in your mouth.
Absolutely. It went from, I'm not sure, to coffee.
Oh, my God. Amazing.
It went from nothing to banana.
I went from absolutely nothing to the minute it came off.
Yeah.
It was pure, devastatingly strong banana.
Chewing on flavored Jelly Bellies can be fun, but the show has also done more conventional on-air taste tests. World-renowned chefs, food scientists, and sometimes just people with a passion for eating and drinking have all brought samples to our studios. There were rare wines.
Now you've done something really unfair, and you've brought a whole bunch of these wines. I don't know how I talk and drink at the same time.
Dim sum.
You also have buns, roast pork buns, chicken buns, lotus seed buns, sweet cream buns.
Bagels.
So it's tough to eat a bagel without lox on it.
Well, you'll have lox in a little while.
Cheese.
So I had this. This is what? This is a French goat cheese?
That's a French Valence from the Loire region. Loire,
mild and nice.
And barbecue.
So everybody will forgive me for chomping and chewing. So the big problem is talking with food in your mouth.
From haute cuisine to the ever so humble, in this vintage clip from the mid-80s, Leonard and his senior edition co-host, Pagin Fitzgerald, talked about their mutual affection for the lemon slice.
Well, do you two ever have a horrible reaction to the antics of someone at a dinner table, something that affects you? I do something that affects two or three of my friends so that they practically fall off their chairs, particularly Kathy Novak. I have, since early girlhood, every time I have sat down to a meal where a quarter of a lemon or lemon slices are served as a garnish, I immediately pick up the quartered lemon or the lemon slices and eat them with relish. Well, that sends Kathy into almost hysterics to see anybody eat anything so sour as a lemon.
Especially with relish on it. Yeah. That sounds like really two strange tastes for mine.
Well, and it's, you know, so many things, unfortunately for my taste, are garnished with lemon quarters or lemon slices. But
Pagin, I'm just like you. I do that as well.
You do?
I don't grab everybody else's lemon. But what I'll do is I'll wait until the meal is halfway gone, and I look over at that lemon and I'll ask, does anybody want that?
I do the same thing, Lenny, and I also to carry it beyond that. For cocktails, if it's some cocktail that either a lemon, preferably a lemon, or even an orange slice is
I'll eat everybody's.
I'll eat everyone's.
And you eat the peel
lemon
as well, I'll bet, just
of course.
As I do. Oh, yes.
Writer Quentin Crisp minced no words when it came to matters of taste. In this 1985 interview, he offered our host a little advice on the best way to talk with people about the things you enjoy.
But don't you feel like you've missed something? The British in obsession with good clarets, for example, Bordeaux
wines.
Find
that all that winemanship, those terrible faces you have to make where you take a little wine into your face and then you purse your lips and raise your eyes to heaven and move your mouth about, and then you say something fatuous, such as, it is an impudent wine. I mean, all this is absolutely detestable. Gulp it down or let it go.
But don't you think that there are better wines and worse wines, that there's better ice cream and worse ice cream, that there's even better Bach and worse Bach?
There may be, but we mustn't. But first of all, we should not allow ourselves to be preoccupied with this. Mm-hmm. And secondly, we should never use our knowledge of ice cream or Bach to flummox other people, to floor other people. Mm. I don't know how you
You realize this you're destroying my life.
Oh, what a pity.
What a sensual thing radio can be. In the right hands, it has fragrance and flavor and color. Over the years, Leonard has spoken in depth with leading and emerging artists and curators of the city's major museum shows, always exploring the meaning of art and what it says about us. One of the first major artists to appear on the program was renowned abstract expressionist Frank Stella. Back in 1988, he weighed in on what he thinks separates an American abstract artist from everyone else.
Do you think that you could spot an American painting from 1952 even if you didn't know the artist?
I think I could, but I mean, there were a lot of I mean, American painting, abstract expressionist painting certainly was imitated, but I think you could tell it usually by the scale. And I don't even necessarily mean that by the size. I mean the scale of the interior gestures. American painting, generally speaking, especially after the war, grew. The gesture, interior gesture within the painting itself grew.
Bigger strokes?
Yes, yes.
And the paintings tend to be larger.
Yeah, the paintings themselves were larger, but the way they were handled, the way they were dust, and also a little bit about even when Europeans splash paint, they're a little bit more delicate about it. I don't know. Somehow they don't quite make as big a mess no matter how hard they try as the Americans do. They really don't want to mess up their studios no matter what they're trying to do.
But what's in a label? In 1999, Lenny posed that question to one of the pioneers of minimalist music, Steve Reich.
One article about you said that you helped launch a musical movement that, and I'm quoting, to his eternal regret, was dubbed minimalism. Is that true? You really don't like the phrase?
Well,
minimalism?
I think that's a little, I think it was Rob Schwartz, who basically knows a lot about me and writes very well, but that was a little journalistic license. You know, if you went to Paris now and went to the grave where Debussy is buried and dug him up and said, you know, excuse moi, monsieur, est-ce que vous êtes impressionniste? He said, nah, I can go back to sleep. You know, these are basically words that people, you know, take, people being music critics, art historians, music historians, and basically take movement in painting and sculpture, like impressionism, expressionism,
fauvism.
Exactly, fauvism.
Wild beast. I don't think Matisse liked it at the beginning, but later I'm sure.
And I don't know if Millot liked it either. The point is, it's taken from painting and sculpture and applied to composers of the period. And it makes sense. It's a handy label to pick up, you know, myself and Terry Riley and Phil Glass and Lamont Young and John Adams and other people. But I think that if you're interested in Impressionism, then you say, wow, Ravel and Debussy and Satie, well, those are just three entirely different composers. And if you're interested in me, the same thing with the people I've just mentioned, that it's mostly useful to people who don't care for it.
Another person who's labored under a heap of labels through the years is Yoko Ono. She tried to clear up just who she is in this award-winning 2008 interview.
Somebody once said, and I'm sure you've heard this so many times you're already bored with it, that you are the most famous artist that whose work nobody knows?
Oh, something like that.
Yes, the most famous unknown artist in the world. Everyone knows who she is, but no one knows what she does. Do you think it's because you've done so many different things?
Well, they say that about, you know, it's an old saying about jack of all trades or whatever, but I didn't care about that. But I don't think that was what it was. Well, maybe a little bit of that, maybe. But the fact that there's so many other factors. I was an Oriental and I was a woman, and also probably most people would have appreciated if I was a little bit sweeter.
A little more demure.
Demure. Maybe that's the language.
Well, if you were asked, what are you, would you say I'm just somebody who does a lot of different arts, or do you think of yourself as a visual artist first and somebody who is involved with music second?
Well, I started to get involved in the music before art, so I can't say that, but let's see now. Well, I really don't know. I mean, if somebody said, what are you? I would say I'm Yoko Ono.
Whether it's musicians, actors, dancers, or painters, Leonard always works to coax his guests into sharing their creative process. In 2004, Meryl Streep offered this insight into her method.
I've had some theater goers tell me that they still treasure the memories of the early things you did on the stage, like when you were in Thomas Babe's Taken in Marriage, and you had that character who was very nervous eating gumdrops endlessly.
Mm.
When you're developing a performance, is something like that a hook for you to aid you in finding a place in the character? Do you remember doing that?
No. All I remember is that I was pregnant. Probably that was why I was sucking on something all the time, because if you have something in your stomach, you keeps the nausea at bay.
And I thought it was such a brilliant device.
Necessity is the mother of invention. Yeah. I don't know. I can't remember that. All I remember about that is that I had perfect hair, and that was very important to me, and a mink, which I'd never had on my body before. And it was sort of nice. You could see why people like them. But yes, I have my real memories of things, performances, have to do with the people that I get to work with. That one, I remember going with Colleen Dewhurst across the street and having a glass of wine between the matinee and the evening performance, and she was such a great gal. Loads of stories. And
well, I know someone who worked as an usher during those performances, and she tells me that every night was different, but every night was thrilling because of the quality of the acting all around.
Yeah, yeah, it was a very exciting group.
So how much research do you do? We've totally blown the whole idea that you had those gumdrops because of some brilliant insight. Do you create a backstory?
Sorry to burst your bubble.
Others can be a little more exacting in their processes. Back in 1996, writer David Foster Wallace gave a rare interview to Leonard where he talked about putting together his monumental novel, Infinite Jest.
You've written, the fiction always comes out so horrifically defective, so hideous a betrayal of all your hopes for it. That's what I really meant.
That though is about what it's like to write the thing, and how marvelous it seems when it's in your head, and how how real and therefore unperfect it seems when it comes out. That was for that little thing they asked me to write about what it was like to write it.
I've had that experience even in the most simple aspects of writing. I'll work something out while I'm in the shower, and then I'll sit down to write it. I've honed it in the shower, and then when, of course, I've forgotten all of those clever little details I stuck in the shower, and what comes out is so much less interesting than that wonderful original germ of an idea.
You know, the whole thing about perfectionism, I mean, you were asking before about the years that I didn't write. The perfectionism is very dangerous because, of course, if your fidelity to perfectionism is too high, you never do anything, because doing anything results, it's actually kind of tragic, because it means you sacrifice how gorgeous and perfect it is in your head for what it really is. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of years, I think, where I really struggled with that. You know, the book is imperfect, but I also know that the book is exactly the best I could have done for the 3 years that I was working on it.
And you never know just what you'll hear. In the late 80s, Leonard asked John Updike what kind of art influenced his early writing. Would you believe Disney cartoons?
Implicit in all his essays is the link between writing and visual art, since both were very important to you from the beginning. Were you aware of those links during those days?
I probably was aware that you needed eyesight to do both, and that both were exercises in seeing to a degree. My first interest was in drawing or cartooning, and I was encouraged by my mother. She actually got the neighbor, who was a painter of sorts, to give me a few lessons, which I remember with more pain than pleasure. But I remember the fact of being given lessons with pleasure. What he did was, speaking of outmoded art techniques, or maybe they still do this, as he said, there's a lot of color in things you don't think are full of color, e.g. a shadow. And he put an egg down in the sunlight and had me paint it, and said there was a rainbow at the edge of the shadow of the egg, and I was supposed to see it. And, of course, I could almost see it, or maybe I really did see it. But I've remembered that in all these years. I wanted to be a kind of, I guess I really wanted to be a Disney employee. The Disney was at his peak, and the full-length classics were coming out once every few years. And the idea of being inside the marvelous engine that made these devices, being an animator, was quite exciting to me. Although by the time I came to be of an age to go looking for a job, the Disney studios were very different, and animation on that scale had more or less dried up. So as so many ambitions, you, what you aim at in your childhood isn't there by the time you're an adult.
Over the years, John Updike, along with writers like T.C. Boyle, Art Spiegelman, Norman Mailer, Calvin Trillin, and countless others, have become friends of the show. And Lenny has even lured some people who rarely give interviews, like Philip Roth and Alice Munro, who spoke to him in 2002.
You've only published one novel, Lives of Girls and Women, and that was in 1971. Do you think you'll ever write another one?
I always think I'll write a novel, and then it turns into a story. But experience is teaching me that I probably won't write another novel. And that novel actually is is divided, in a way most novels aren't, into sections that are not quite stories, but are... I found when I was writing it that I couldn't handle the traditional novel form, and I wanted to put things into those kind of story boxes, so I did.
Well, your short stories are getting longer and longer.
They're getting longer and longer.
Some
Who
of them
knows?
Are over 50 pages in this
That's
book,
right.
almost novellas. So eventually you might just write three novellas and wind up with...
Actually, I count the pages and I wonder how near... Is this a novel?
Well, but the difference is that novels allow for a lot more digression, and that's
yes.
the reason some people prefer them. Short stories tend to be more concentrated. Do you think writing longer short stories is allowing you to be more novelistic?
I don't really understand what is novelistic. It's really allowing me to have more digression and more latitude and to put, you know, just to broaden out. And I know I like to do this. I've always liked to do it. But I'm not sure that this tendency would lead me to writing a novel. I seem to broaden out about it. I always do more than I expected, but it never changes in the way a novel should.
I'm Brooke Gladstone, and we're celebrating the 25th anniversary of Leonard Lopate on New York Public Radio. We have to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more of the show's favorite moments from the WNYC archives after this. Welcome back. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Leonard Lopate Show turns 25 today, and we're playing a few select samples of the program from over the years. One of the problems in trying to describe Leonard is that he doesn't fit easily into any mold. It's an issue former Tonight Show host Steve Allen addressed in 1990.
I thought that one of the problems that Joan Rivers had in doing that show is that she wasn't out of that Steve Allen mold, and Johnny Carson... definitely his own man, but still shares in common with you the ability to ad lib.
Yes, and
David Letterman as well, and they're the big successes.
Yes, talent, oddly enough, is not necessary, as I've said before, to host a talk show. It doesn't help, or it doesn't hurt, I should say, if you have
You're really
any.
Ruining my career today.
No.
First you said this was an easy job, and then you said I don't need talent.
Well, there are various forms of talk shows. I call this really an interview show, and you do it superbly.
6 years later, Lenny showed off his interviewing chops and his research abilities when he sparred with former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger.
You were the National Security Advisor at the time of the overthrow?
Yes.
Henry Kissinger is my guest. His latest book, his 12th, is Years of Renewal, the concluding volume of his memoirs. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and you're listening to Radio New York, AMA 20, WNYC. In the memoir, you mention Indonesia several times, but never East Timor, yet you and President Ford left Jakarta one day before Indonesia's invasion of the country, and a State Department memorandum says you and Ford gave approval to Suharto's invasion of East Timor. They did so with 90% of their weapons coming from the United States.
I don't know what State Department memorandum you're talking about, and... We were told at the airport as we left Jakarta that either that day or the next day they intended to take East Timor. Secondly, to us it looked, we can't say that we were great experts in East Timor. The population of about 800,000.
200,000 of whom have died since that invasion.
Yeah, that may be so, but I'm saying what did we know at the time? It looked to us like the Indian occupation of Goa a few years earlier. And it happened in a year when Southeast Asia, when Indochina had collapsed. So it wasn't a question of approval. It was a question of not being able to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the case of Indonesia, we're talking about a country that is rich in natural resources. We really overlooked an awful lot in the...
during the Suharto years, and only now are the Indonesians gaining some kind of revenge.
Well, I think that you have a very peculiar perspective on foreign policy, if I may say so.
Probably.
I've never
worked in government, so I'm
and
just...
And a very one-sided approach. I think any objective person would say that tremendous economic strides were made in Indonesia during the Suharto period.
But they've all fallen apart, haven't they? And the country's going through a terrible economic turmoil.
Now they fell apart as a result of the Asian economic crisis, and Indonesia is now going through a very big political crisis.
Interviewing Henry Kissinger about his long public track record is one thing, but what about someone who's only beginning to gain traction as a major force in American politics? 6 years ago, Barack Obama was a freshman U.S. senator from Illinois who had burst onto the national scene following his keynote address to the Democratic Convention. In 2004, Leonard asked him about what his future might hold.
How did you come to be chosen as the keynote speaker at the convention?
Well, you know, keep in mind the context of this race. You know, when I announced that I was running for the U.S. Senate 2 years ago, I think the general estimation in Illinois was that I probably would be the best U.S. senator, but I didn't have much of a chance of winning because I had no money, I had no organization support, and I had this ballot name that just made people go crazy. They said, you know, nobody can pronounce it. How are you ever going to be able to get votes?
But they do remember it.
But they do remember it once they get it. And we ended up having an extraordinarily successful primary victory. We ended up winning not only the black vote, but the white vote, suburban vote, as well as the city vote. We won in downstate, primarily agricultural districts that nobody would have anticipated somebody like myself winning. And so I think it created a sense of hopefulness coming out of that primary that I could beat somebody who spent $30 million or the anointed choice of the Democratic machine. And it made people feel good. Now, John Kerry then came to campaign with me and I think saw me speak at an event for him. And I guess they were favorably impressed. And so a couple of weeks before... probably about a month before the convention, they called and asked if I'd be interested in speaking.
And you went from being a guy who didn't have a chance in the primary to someone who some people are suggesting might be a future presidential candidate.
Yeah, it's a pretty big leap. I don't take the presidential talk too seriously. I'm ranked 99th in seniority in the Senate. I'll be
didn't hurt John Edwards.
I'll be sharpening pencils for a while and carrying the bags of Carl Levin and Pat Leahy.
Seniority may be everything in the Senate, but it didn't help Senator Joe Biden in his 2008 bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. He and Leonard sat down in 2007 to talk about his faltering campaign.
So what happens, Joe, if, I know this is almost impossible to imagine, if you don't win the Democratic nomination and
now you're
become
being
an
a wise guy. No, up to now you're being wise. Everybody likes a guy, but nobody likes a wise guy. But go ahead, wise guy.
Now what happens then? You're going to stay in the Senate?
I'm chairman of the. Assuming I run again and am reelected, I'd be chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee and begin to continue to try to have an influence on the administration.
Leonard has a talent for putting the focus on topics before they dominate the media spotlight. The show-produced series on AIDS, homelessness, and the oil spill in Newtown Creek long before those issues were major news stories. And it's something Lenny and his staff continue to do to this day with the underreported Backstory and Please Explain series. But I think the moments that stick with us, the ones that keep us all listening, are the ones when the interviewer, who is our surrogate, asks and probes, listens and leads guests to reveal their true selves, like in this 1990 interview with playwright Wendy Wasserstein.
A friend commented that you share with Renata Tebaldi the attribute of having dimples of steel.
In the Heidi Chronicles, there's a line, what makes you a person keeps you from being a person.
Uh-huh.
How does that apply to you?
I was also thinking in Heidi, at one point, is called a vicious dumpling, which is, I think I might be closer to a vicious dumpling than dimples of iron. What makes you a person keeps you from being a person? Because I think things get knotted up and complicated. And I think what makes you interesting is also what makes you eccentric. What makes you vulnerable is also what makes you sensitive. Mm. You know, both. It's like knots.
All the time that you've been writing plays, you've been writing essays, often on assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Are you attracted to the essay form?
Yes, I love the essay form. In a way, one, because you don't have to postpone gratification. You write it and hopefully someone prints it, but it's not a two-year process and you don't have to wait for Joan Allen's availability and see, you know, if Chris Lotti can do your show and what theater.
How much it's going to cost to get the sets.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's a very different thing. It's also you can write about different things than you write about in a play. Like one of my essays is about a child's chess tournament in Romania, and I'm certainly not going to write a play about that. You could, but I'm not going to.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But you're also at times expected to be a lot more honest about yourself than you are anywhere else. That's the biggest problem with the essay. You can't be. You can't say I and invent somebody.
No.
It just is not believable.
No, but in a way, see, for someone like me who's used to writing characters, it's a release to write I, and it's a release to use that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoy that.
It's remarkable how Lenny can talk about the role of self in the essay and then transition seamlessly into issues that have huge global scope. In 1999, he sat down with South African cleric Desmond Tutu to talk about the fall of apartheid.
Now, when you became Archbishop of Cape Town, you set three goals for yourself. One, the ordination of women priests, which the church approved in 1992. Two, the division of the Cape Town diocese into smaller units. And three, the liberation of all South Africans. Now, that last one was a bit different in scale, a little more ambitious than the other two.
Well, we've had such a spectacular vindication for all of those people who participated in the struggle, for the many, many people in other parts of the world who supported us. And so it's been fantastic.
But becoming Archbishop allowed you to set that kind of goal, didn't it? Although I suspect that the more prominent you became, the more pressure was put on you to scale back that sort of thinking.
Well, you've got to aim for the stars and just might fortunately land on top of the mountain. And it was important for our people that those goals were held up before them, especially at a time when evil seemed to be on the rampage and evil seemed to be going to triumph. It was important for all of us that our morale was upheld by our belief that these things can be done.
Now, here you were, one of the most famous people in the world, a Nobel Prize winner, but you didn't have an opportunity to vote until 1994. You were 62 years old. Is that true?
This is one of the most bizarre things, that Nelson Mandela had to wait until he was 70-some.
But at least he became president. I mean, he went right to the top when he voted.
It is just one of the wonderful examples of God's sense of humor.
First time he votes, he becomes president.
Isn't it? Yes, I mean, the prisoner who becomes president. And then someone who had been vilified as the most ghastly terrorist ends up being this icon of reconciliation and forgiveness and gets all of the people who used to vilify him eating out of his hand because he became such a fantastic embodiment of reconciliation.
When he's not hosting his show here on WNYC, Leonard is interviewing even more people in front of a live audience at the 92nd Street Y and elsewhere.
And now we regularly get to hear Lenny with a live audience in WNYC's new Jerome L. Green performance space. Tennis star Andre Agassi stopped by last year to talk about his memoir, Open.
Didn't your father once try to bet your entire family's fortune on a game between you, a nine-year-old, and Jim Brown, the great football player?
Yeah, he did. He did, you know. And I got to say, it's a powerful emotion that a young man feels when a boy feels that when their father is so proud of him, but also that believes in him so much. I mean, he thought I could beat everybody. And,
well, you couldn't rush 5 yards average as Jim Brown did, but
no,
he probably
couldn't.
Could beat him at tennis.
Well, yeah, you're about to find out. If you read the book, you would know no, I'm kidding. I know you read the book. I walk into my club, a Cambridge Racquet Club, and Jim Brown's in there. He used to always play for money and stuff, and a money match fell through, so he ends up yelling at the manager, you know, you got to get me somebody to play for money. I came here to play and I want to bet. And my dad says, you're looking for a game. My son will play you. And he goes, I only play for money. He goes, he'll play for whatever you want. So how much do you want to bet? My dad says, I'll bet you our house. And Jim Brown responds with, I don't need your house. I have a house. What do you say we play for 10 grand? He says, fine. So we're about to go on the court. He says, I want to see the money. My dad says, wait here, Andre. Drives home. Goes in his life savings, and we always kept it basically under a mattress. I mean, he didn't trust banks, he didn't trust anybody. And he comes back with $10,000. And meanwhile, the manager's telling Jim Brown, listen, Jim, this kid's going to beat you, and that's a problem because you won't come back here anymore. So Jim Brown starts assessing me. He starts asking me questions about how often I play, and I tell him I play every day. He says, well, you know, how often do you win? I go, or lose? I go, I never lose. I mean, I just... In my house, losing is not an option. And so he pulls a bet down and says, here's what we'll do. We'll play two sets, and we'll play the third set for money, and we'll decide how much after I get a sense. So I was so relaxed. I went out there, and I kind of dragged him along a little bit because at this point now I wanted some action, right? I didn't want 10,000 worth of action. But so I drag him along, and I beat him pretty handily the first two sets, and then he wants to bet 500, and he bends down and ties his shoes and starts playing a lot better than I, you know, he did the first two sets as well. And
was he setting you up?
He was. So I, you know, I just kind of clicked up a couple notches, and he can only click up one, and I gave him a beating.
Serves him right.
Lenny is the first to admit that he can't keep up on everything happening in pop culture. For proof, he'd point you in the direction of this 2005 interview with funk legend Bootsy Collins.
I get the sense that this was an opportunity for you to call upon a lot of different people who have been friends or who you've been interested in playing with over the years and saying, hey, let's do a thing together.
Yes, yes. It's a big opportunity for me because I get a chance to kind of vibe with the artists and entertainers behind the scenes, you know, and that's really good.
I just wonder if Snoopy Dogg and the Chili Peppers are doing a mashup together. Does that mean that the mashup phenomenon has gone mainstream?
I wouldn't say mainstream.
I keep on saying Snoopy. It's Snoop. Of course, Snoopy is the guy in Peanuts.
Yeah, that's the animation.
That's Peanuts. I don't know. I guess it just automatically
cool.
Tips up my tongue.
I like the way you say that, man. Let me hear it one more time.
Snoop Dogg.
No, Snoopy, man.
As every interviewer knows, sometimes a conversation just goes off the rails. And there are times when a guest won't even get on the train. Dr. Lasse Hessel, the inventor of the female condom, which we mentioned earlier, was one of those people. His creation, the Femidom, was supposed to be as groundbreaking as the birth control pill. But in this 1993 interview, Dr. Hessel has a little trouble selling his revolutionary product, and we assure you, this is real.
This year, one more method of birth control will become available to women in the United States. It's called Femidom, a female condom. And here to tell us about it is Dr. Lasse Hessel, who is its developer. Very pleased to welcome him to New York & Company. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon to you.
A female condom, it sounds impossible.
No.
Because a condom is something that slips around something else, isn't it?
No, not the new female condom. I didn't actually develop it. I invented it years ago.
This is not that new, is it? Because in the 20s, didn't a number of French women wear vaginal sheets of vulcanized rubber?
I haven't heard about that.
Uh-huh.
That's new to me.
Correct. Now, why polyurethane?
I think that's that question will have to be put to the factory distributor.
Is this perfectly? Is this 100% effective?
Again, you will have to ask Wisconsin Pharmacal, who's actually doing it here.
You report that when you used it, at least when it was first developed, that it was a bit noisy. Why is it noisy?
Again, I can't comment on that.
The reason that people give for using condoms is because right now there is a serious problem of sexually transmitted diseases, a problem that seems to have suddenly sprung up in the last 20 years or so. And women are more susceptible to these diseases than men. Do we have any idea of why that is?
No.
And how much is it planned? Do you have any idea how much it's going to be sold for?
No, no idea.
It's also pre-lubricated with silicone, not with a spermicide. Why is that?
I don't know.
You're the inventor. You don't know the answers to most of these questions?
I invented the female condom. Yeah.
Okay, well, the book is published by Crawford House Press. I thank you so much for having been on New York & Company.
Thank you very much.
Broadway legends, past, present, and future, have filed through Leonard's studio for decades, and one of the show's favorites was Carol Channing. Take a listen to this exchange from 2002.
Was there ever a time when you said to yourself, if I have to sing Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend one more time, I'll scream?
No, I never said that. I never said that.
You always loved this song.
Who said I should?
No, I never said anybody. I just wondered, because you had to sing it so many times.
Never. I never got tired of it. There's something wrong with me. I never get tired of Diamonds or Dolly or anything in it.
But nobody, people don't seem to remember that you didn't sing Hello, Dolly. You were Dolly. They
yes.
were singing it to you. So do people ask you to sing it all the time now?
Drunks in bars do. It must have taken the place of Melancholy Baby. And they do. And I stand there like a fool trying to explain to them why I can't sing it. I sang Hello, Harry, Hello, Louie, and all that. But I did sing Wow, 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 Fellas, Look at the Ogre. By the way, didn't I have a lyric soprano voice in that fraught record?
Yeah, you were much higher.
What's happened? To me.
You're just lucky, I guess.
Lucky, I guess.
The Leonard has been at it for 25 years. Morley Safer put it best when he appeared on the program last year.
My guess is Morley Safer, who will be celebrating 40 years on 60 Minutes.
40 years.
Wow. I mean, I've been here almost 25 years. I thought that was a lifetime.
Just a kid.
From all of us here at WNYC, happy 25th anniversary, kid. Leonard Lopate, 25 Live on WNYC. Was produced by Stephen Valentino with help from Blakeney Schick and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan was the executive producer. We had engineering help from Rex Doan and Bill O'Neill. Andy Lancet provided archival assistance. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Thanks for listening.